On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Curtis, Heather, and I talk with Kevin Anderson about POS systems and using your data to scale your business. Plus, we talk about how Google's in the hot seat with the EU on GDPR violations. They might have some pretty hefty fines. Take a listen because it might just help your organization on GDPR. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 326, Appetize. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by WordPress. Turn your dreams into reality and launch your website at WordPress.com. Get 15% off any new plan at WordPress.com/Twit. And by Sophos Cybersecurity. In an age of evolving cyber threats, you need evolved cybersecurity. Powered by artificial intelligence, Sophos can detect threats before they strike, killing ransomware, viruses, and other cyber threats dead in their tracks. Get a free security scan and our free trial today at Sophos.com. And by Atlassian. Atlassian's software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com to find out which Atlassian tools are right for your team and give their products a try for free. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the brains of this outfit, the enterprise tech experts that will lead the way, starting with Heather Williams, Senior Product Solutions Architect at Rutgers Network. Mo, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. Now you're remotely monitoring a pretty tasty meal that's coming up soon.
Yes, I have my app going. We're going to be serving pulled pork in a couple of hours.
Fantastic. I think I need to get one of those because it's always great to be able to remotely monitor your tasty meal that's coming up later. So we'll have to see and look into that. Well, folks, we like to stack the deck here on Twit. We tend to overachieve, and the way we can do that is by also adding Mr. Curtis Franklin, Senior Editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, how's it going down there in the swamp?
Well, we're a little bit cooler than normal here in the swamp, but still not too bad. No snow on the ground, no ice anywhere but in our tropical drinks. So we'll call it a great day and a fine afternoon to be here on Twit.
Fantastic. Well, speaking of stacking the deck, we have quite the show today. We actually are going to talk a little bit about how one of the large cloud providers out there may be hit with some GDPR sanctions. And we have a great guest from Appetize to talk about enterprise POS and how to scale your organization's data by using data. But before we do, we had a pretty great week of enterprise tech news. So let's go ahead and jump into the blips. Now, it wouldn't be a week of enterprise news without news about either researchers or individuals alike finding a new malicious campaign to trick users. Now, we're seeing an upward trend and some of these actually targeting Macs as well. Now, this malicious campaign is triggered 5 million times per day and uses highly camouflaged JavaScript stashed in images to install a Trojan on the visitor's Mac. Now, cloaked by an ad campaign, the ad image, which is displayed to the right of the text box, looks like any other ad, but using a clever HTML trick under the hood, it's able to deliver the malicious code. Now, with the way they did that is they create a canvas object, which developers use to render graphics objects. And if the computer had a Mac-specific font installed, the object would then loop through the underlining data in the image and convert it to every pixel in the loop into alphanumeric characters. Now, after adding each newly extracted character to a string, it was able to put it together into some malicious code. Now, this code would redirect Mac users to a website that served and displayed ads that falsely claimed that the visitor's Flash player was out of date. Remember this? Now, visitors who took the bait were actually then infected with Slayer, a Mac Trojan that came to light about 11 months ago, and it used to install adware. Now, this month's campaign is not the first of its kind. A similar campaign in December targeted Macs and iOS devices. Now, Wednesday's post said that the group also targeted Windows-based computers as well, but there's no mention that the ads use similar stenographic techniques. Now, if there any if there was any time for you to go and grab an ad blocker, I think this would be a good time. So go ahead and get one right now and see if you can start blocking this Trojan.
Well, for hackers and researchers, a critical tool, Metasploit, got its first major upgrade in 8 years. Metasploit is one of those tools that can be found in the toolkit of every pen tester and pretty much every hacker, and almost all of them are now thinking through how a new version of Metasploit, the first major release since 2011, is going to change their research and testing workflow. Metasploit 5.0, released earlier this month by Rapid7, offers a host of new features and capabilities, along with the promise of a faster annual update cycle for the product. New capabilities carried with the first new cycle release begin with support for three languages, Go, Python, and Ruby. The development support continues with a new framework, JSON RPC API, a common web services framework that exposes all the available APIs to users. Another new capability, the database as a RESTful service, is intended to make contributions from the user community even easier. Metasploit's developers expect some of the new contributions to use expanded capabilities, such as the evasion modules and libraries, which are now included with Metasploit 5.0. They also believe that new tools and capabilities will come to the community because of the service-oriented nature of the new MetaShell. Multiple consoles can now be deployed and draw on resources hosted essentially anywhere the internet can reach, bringing Metasploit in line with the architecture increasingly used for applications and frameworks alike.
For my first blip this week, I'm announcing a new protocol called CURT. No, it's not my co-host. I'm calling it Karma in Real Time. And all that, though that is fake news, it was inspired by a story this week by ZDNet about a new ransomware strain. Normally, not even I would find this amusing, but this one is locking up Bitcoin mining rigs in China. This ransomware has been around since last year, but a new wave of infections has been reported hitting mining farms earlier this month. It threatens to overheat and destroy mining rigs if the victim doesn't either infect 1,000 other devices or doesn't pay a 10 Bitcoin ransom, which is worth about $36,000. The infection targets various types of mining rigs that's used for Bitcoin and Litecoin mining. It's not clear how the initial infection is accomplished, but some Chinese security experts suggested that it comes hidden inside tainted versions of mining rig firmware that's been making the rounds online since last summer. Once infected, the mining rig immediately locks and prevents it from mining any new currency. A splash screen depicts an ant and two pickaxes in green. And then similar to the red skull splash screen that's displayed in the NotPetya ransomware. The ransom note is in both English and Chinese, and it gives the victims a choice of paying a Bitcoin ransom to remove the ransomware, or they can download a firmware update that they then have to apply to other mining rigs to further spread the ransom. Ransomware. If a victim fails to pay it or fails to infect the other devices, a ransom note threatens to turn off the mining rig's fan and its overheat protection, leading to the device's destruction. There haven't been any reports of any destroyed equipment just yet, but the experts say that theoretically it could abuse an overclocking feature in the Antminer firmware to overheat and compromise devices. Besides financial losses caused after the ransomware stops normal mining operations, the victims also reported losses caused by the time needed to reflash the infected mining equipment's SD card and remove the ransomware and then install a clean firmware. All of this begs the question, brother, can you spare a Bitcoin?
Now, the digital transformation of the healthcare industry has been muddy at best in the past years. Now, there's data silos, inefficient, insecure systems that plague that industry. Well, IBM and its consortium of large organizations thinks they might have the answer to the problem. The group will experiment with a version of blockchain known as Hyperledger Fabric in a bid to reduce administrative errors and streamline record keeping. Now, if I remember correctly, someone predicted on Twiat that the healthcare industry might be the next to adopt this technology, but there wasn't a large enough of set of players out there backing it to bring the concept to life. Now, this group made up of IBM, PNC Bank and Healthcare Service Corporation might have enough capital to actually move it along. Now, this industry is quite plagued in legacy systems and data silos. It seems that the first areas of the industry the group will target are revenue cycle management and bundled payment solutions as areas where blockchain can actually improve outcomes. Now, IBM is not the only company promoting blockchain in the health sector. Walmart last year obtained a patent to use blockchain for medical records, and researchers at hospitals around the world are experimenting with it in everything from patient records to diagnostics. Now, we are also seeing the pharmaceutical industry consortium launched at an initiative in 2017 called the MediLedger Project, which seeks to better track pills across the supply chain. Now, we might just have to revisit our predictions at the end of the year to see how close we are and see how the industry is coming with blockchainifying itself.
Well, there's a new emergency directive out from the Department of Homeland Security, and it's all about DNS for those folks running .gov sites. On January the 22nd, U.S. CERT issued notice of a CISA emergency directive on DNS infrastructure tampering. Now, the notice was the typical brief CERT notice, but it linked to an emergency directive at the Department of Homeland Security that called on anyone managing .gov or other agency-managed domains to take a series of steps aimed at remedial efforts and to take those steps very, very quickly. In the emergency directive, DHS said, quote, attackers have redirected and intercepted web and mail traffic and could do so for other network services, end quote. The directive points out that the attacks began when someone stole, obtained, or compromised user credentials for an account able to make changes to the DNS records. Most experts think the events alluded to in the emergency directive are related to a campaign of DNS attacks described by FireEye in a blog post dated January 9th. In that post, researchers said that attackers, most likely employed or sponsored by agencies in Iran, used a variety of techniques to gain access to and control over DNS servers. FireEye wrote that the attacks appeared to have begun as long ago as 2017 and prominently feature a technique first described by researchers at Cisco Talos in which the DNSA records are modified. This technique results in the attacker gaining a user's username, password, and domain credentials without producing any activity that would alert the user to a problem. The attack described heavily uses Let's Encrypt, a service which allows someone to easily get a certificate for a domain they control. The attackers went in, modified the records, then immediately got a certificate from Let's Encrypt so people coming in from other domains would not get an error message. As for the emergency directive's mandates, they include auditing DNS records, changing passwords for accounts that have DNS admin privileges, and putting two-factor authentication into service, doing it all within 10 days. One expert said that this is a wake-up call for anyone who owns a domain, because although the U.S. government is issuing the order, anyone anywhere in the world who is admin for a DNS server should be paying a lot of attention to this one.
An ape, a mermaid, and a YouTuber go into a bar. My last blip for the day isn't specifically about enterprise technology, but many in the Twilight Riot are gamers, and this story continues my New Year's resolution to try and have at least one feel-good blip per show. Last weekend, Harry Brewis, a British YouTube personality better known as H-Bomber Guy, completed 101% of Donkey Kong 64 while live-streaming it in a 57-hour marathon. All of this was done for the benefit of a British charity, Mermaids, an advocacy group for the transgender youth in the UK. The group lobbies for improvements in professional services for transgender children and has won numerous awards over the years for their work. After Congressman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a number of gaming personalities and other celebrities like Cher and Neil Gaiman appeared on the stream. It went viral, and over $340,000 was raised, all of it going to Mermaids. If you missed any of the action, the full live stream can be watched on Twitch.
Now, once in a while, you'll catch people crossing a street or taking a different route in order to evade surveillance systems on the roads or buildings. Now, if you are around the corner from a camera, it can't see you or watch you. Well, researchers might have found a way to scare you a bit more. They have developed a computer program that lets cameras see around corners. Now, the process is called computational periscopy, and it works by analyzing shadows casted on a wall and applying a decoding algorithm onto them. Now, don't get too crazy yet. Now, some of the practical use cases for this technology could be autonomous vehicles in order to avoid accidents or disasters around corners. Now, it could also be used for the military to evade the enemy. But the most interesting thing about this technology is that you don't need any special equipment to achieve the results. In the past, this was thought that it was practically impossible to reconstruct an image from only scattered light from a wall without any advanced instruments. Now, all this process needs is a source image, such as a picture of the wall receiving light from a scene and shadows cast by an object hidden around the corner. Now, more specifically, it needs a penumbra, which is the outer edge of a shadow cast by an opaque object. Then the algorithms developed by the researchers can work backwards from them to reconstruct a picture of the original scene. Now, basically, they are unscrambling light here. Now, it's only a matter of time that these algorithms will be enhanced to support object size and other detailed components of an image. We might just soon see real-time video streams of around the corner. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But first, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's WordPress. Now, when you think of a blog or a site out there, for me, I think WordPress. Now, even if it's for you or your organization and you have something to say or an idea you want to get out there, WordPress is going to make it easy for you. Now, when I had a time to actually blog, WordPress was my platform of choice. I started out with a free tier with them and their masterful wizard that lets you get through all the custom sites information and get it up in less than a couple minutes. Now, if you're like me, I like to browse all the other options and add to the site. So it took me a bit longer, but it still came out pretty beautiful. Now, over time, as the site grew, I wanted more complex theming components and features and some support on how to do some of the more complex things. So I went to the paid tier. But it was really easy to switch, and it was really worth it to do. Now, WordPress is easy to get up and running fast, whether it's up for your personal site or you want a site for your organization. Now, WordPress can handle the complete spectrum of features and scale and all of your creativity. Now, one of the most powerful features of WordPress, in my opinion, is the plugin capabilities. You want a social streaming plugin to ensure your posts and content are advertised across social media? Well, use a plugin. Now, don't take my word for it. Go ahead and check out this stat. Now, WordPress now powers 33% of the internet. Over one third of the internet is powered by WordPress. Now, Leo has been using WordPress for over 12 years. Check out his leolaporte.com. But there are tons of millions of people out there and tons of large organizations actually powered by WordPress. So check it out. I actually been to some of the WordPress conferences where there's been implementers, designers, or front-end masters alike, where they attend to see what's going on in the industry and what's going on with WordPress. Well, they are some of the most informative conferences out there. In fact, some of the most advanced front-end developers and masters of design I know started with WordPress, and they continue to use the platform today. The great thing about this platform, it's not just for developers and front-end masters. If you have an idea and you want to get it out there, WordPress can get you started super fast. Now, with a powerful site building tools and thousands of themes and 24/7 support from real experts, WordPress.com lets anyone pursue whatever it is they love and launch and want to launch on a site, starting with a free tier and moving and with room to grow later on. Now, there's no two-week trials, no hidden fees, and WordPress users own their content forever. Now, join the ranks of all the millions of people who use WordPress each day to share with us their vision, views, and ideas. For you and our loyal listeners, we have a way to sweeten the deal for you with WordPress. We give you 15% off on any new plan. It's a great way to get started with room to grow. Go to WordPress.com/twit for 15% off any new plan purchase. That's WordPress.com/twit for 15% off your new website, WordPress.com/twit. And we thank WordPress for their support and This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now that time for us to jump into the bites for this week, and we have a pretty interesting one. Now, you probably thought it was the last time you've heard about GDPR when it went active May 2018. Well, it scared a ton of organizations to change their ways and start offering better data transparency for people and organizations. Now, you guys probably remember we even discussed this, whether we thought that large cloud providers such as Amazon, Microsoft, and Google would actually be affected by GDPR. In fact, I remember thinking, hey, these guys know how big they are, so and how large sanctions might be if they get in trouble or violate GDPR. So they're probably going to take the appropriate steps to ensure the compliancy. Well, it seems that one of them didn't take enough steps. If you remember, now GDPR, which is called the General Protection Regulation, applies automatically to all 28 members of the European Union, and companies that are found guilty of misusing data are fined up to £20 million or $26.5 million. Or 4% of the company's annual revenue. Now, it seems Google is in the hot seat this time. A French government agency known as acronym CNIL, or in English, that means the National Commission on Informatics and Liberty, has it out for Google. They are claiming that they violated two provisions of GDPR law. First, by not making its data collection policies easily accessible enough. And second, by not obtaining sufficient and specific user consent for ad personalization across each of Google's numerous services, including YouTube, Google Maps, and more. So this is interesting because now over the past year, rules and regulations around GDPR have been tweaked to be a bit more clear, but they're still kind of open for interpretation. There's kind of room for interpretation here. Now, Heather, I want to go to you first because organizations have kind of different ways to kind of interpret rules and regulations and policies around this. Now, GDPR is not really clear in the definition of what easy is here. Is this just a ploy to kind of target Google here?
Well, I love the air quotes. And I don't actually think that it's Google that's being targeted. I think that they're making a case for, see, we were serious about this when we told you you need to take it, you need to pay attention to this. I think you're right that companies did sort of lose their mind, but I think that those who were being very, very careful about it are going to find out. It's everything that I've seen about GDPR is that it actually has teeth and that it's going to actually start working. I got to tell you, I mean, anybody in InfoSec will tell you that privacy is not an easy thing. If it was easy to accomplish, about half of them wouldn't be in business. So, I don't know what the answer is. I will tell you that personally, we were affected by this. We run at work. I run a sandbox, or my team runs a sandbox for proof of concept. We had to take a hard look at what data was being collected in what country, from what countries, and really pay attention to this.
Right. Yeah, I think that it's interesting because a lot of organizations pay attention, but they tend to have their own interpretation. So to me, Curtis, I want to throw this to you. Like, to me, the first and second claims that they have here are kind of weak because, again, consent is under interpretation, as well as how easy it is to make things accessible. So do you feel that maybe things need to change around the definition for GDPR so organizations have a better understanding? Because I know that lots of organizations have massive, large law firms kind of helping them out here to help them interpret. It looks like Google might have interpreted this wrong, and they probably pay quite a bit of chunk of change there to get the law firms to help them. So what do you think? Is this something that maybe something needs to change for GDPR?
Well, I don't think that anything is going to change for GDPR. What I think we're going to see is the courts putting some meat on the hangers of words like easy and consent and things like that. I had seen the NOIB action against Facebook, which happened at roughly the same time. It happened in Switzerland rather than France, but it was much the same, basically saying, look, GDPR makes the point that individuals own their own data and requires companies collecting and holding that data to both make it possible for consumers to control how their data is used and make it easy for that to happen. So how close to the surface do the controls for that ease have to be? How close to the surface do consent mechanisms have to be? I mean, do these have to be buttons that render at, you know, so many pixels by so many pixels on the homepage? Do they have to be available within so many layers of website click through? That's what we don't know. And that's what the courts are going to have to define. I think everyone knew this was going to be happening. And I suspect that most companies out there are thrilled that it's Google and Facebook who are paying the legal bills to help define this. To be brutally honest, I would not be surprised if Google isn't very pleased to have some definition of these terms happening. And knowing Google, they probably figure that $57 million is a relative bargain for getting those definitions.
Right. Well, I know that Google, I know, Heather, I'm going to throw this back to you because I know you see a lot of organizations, you work with a lot of organizations. What are they doing? What are they making the appropriate moves here for GDPR? Are you seeing what are they actually doing to make sure that they're compliant?
Well, and once again, I think Kurt hit it on the nail on the head with some of his comments. I think he's right that we need that these companies are looking for better definitions. But in the race up to the last year when it was being deployed, I know an awful lot of companies that were hiring an awful lot of lawyers. Just to make sure they were combing through the legalese and making sure that I's were dotted and T's were crossed. The companies I saw reacting to it were reacting with an abundance of caution and making sure, you know, if there was something that they thought would cross the line, pull it down first. First do no harm, first get sued last. And I think you made a good point, you know, letting Google and Facebook take it in the teeth. It helps everyone else, but Kurt was right. I think that Google, this gives them an opportunity to shape the conversation and help shape and define what is going to be enforced and how it's going to be enforced going forward. There was a conversation earlier over the last week about whether companies like regulation or dislike regulation. And I think that what we saw with Facebook jumping in front of Congress was in an effort to shape the conversation about what regulation was going to happen. It's coming. They know that there's going to be, you know, the pendulum will swing. There's going to be some fallback because of a lot of the data breaches or misuse of trust. And by the way, I don't care what you say about the, you know, terms and conditions. The biggest lie ever told was, I have read the terms and conditions. I accept them. Nobody's ever read those. So I don't know how you're going to get around.
Right. Like kind of a little bit on that. I mean, I want to throw this back to you, Kurt, real quick for the last question here is that, you know, I would think that this organization would have wanted a little bit more teeth on their their claims here, especially against a company like Google. Because they do have information policies and they do make it accessible. Now, whether how accessible it is like what's in claim here, and as well as, you know, how visible they make ad information, how they use that. I'm not sure. Again, it's up to interpretation. I would have thought that there would have been more teeth here, especially if they want to make an example of it. I think you might be right, is that organizations might use this as a way to say, okay, this is what they're going to be targeting. Let's go ahead and switch this around. Why do you think that this organization decided just to target these two very simple kind of shallow things?
Well, again, the organizations that are challenging this, just like the organizations that are being challenged, do have finite resources. So I think that just like the organizations that are being challenged, Facebook and Google and the rest, NOIB and the other privacy organizations want to see precisely where the courts are going to draw these rather broad lines that have been suggested by GDPR. I don't think they were looking for big monetary fines here. That wasn't the point of these actions. These actions were to get the courts to make some decisions and give some precise guidelines for what companies need to be doing. Now, when it comes to teeth, most of the people that I know are looking at the Starwood Marriott breach to see exactly what kind of teeth the regulators are going to give to GDPR, because it's there in the data loss category where private data is not protected, that GDPR has some fairly stiff penalties, the kind that will get the attention of even a large multinational corporation. So what I see here are the same sort of lawsuits. It reminds me a great deal of what happened in the U.S. around HIPAA 15 years ago, where there were some kind of broad statements, and a lot of organizations were waiting for the first lawsuits to be filed to see precisely where the lines would be drawn within those regulations. That process is happening within GDPR and the various European regulators now. I suspect that by this time next year, we'll have much better ideas about where the lines are drawn. Until those lines are firmly drawn by the courts, we're going to have some relatively low penalties, except in cases where data is actually lost. So, like I said, when you want to see about the teeth, wait for Marriott. They're going to be the first, I suspect, to have a really big bite taken out of their financial posterior.
Fantastic. Well, I think we've done enough with GDPR today. Let's go ahead and jump into the next bite. I'm going to throw this over to you, Kurt, talk about IT job market.
Well, it's interesting because we all know that for young people and even older people looking for well-paying jobs, the IT industry is good. And within the IT industry, there's one area in particular that continues to see the jobs that fetch top dollar. That is cybersecurity, which remains near the top of the most wanted list in enterprise technology hiring, and the salaries continue to reflect that fact. Now, that was according to a new tech salary guide released earlier this week by tech staffing agency Mondo, which released the 2019 Tech and Digital Marketing Salary Guide. Now, they place CISOs in the number two position on the list for highest annual salary, just behind CTO/CIO, with salaries that range from $175,000 to $275,000 a year. Other top security titles include things like manager of information security and application security engineer, both of which have salaries that range up to the mid-180s, network security engineer with salaries that range up to the mid-170s, and cybersecurity engineer with a salary range that tops out in the mid-160s. In addition to the security positions, the survey reports that Salesforce.com developers and people who work in things like artificial intelligence and machine learning, along with the Internet of Things, are demanding salaries that can easily hit $200,000 a year. So if you say to yourself, gee, if I do machine learning about security in the IoT, I should be able to make a bundle of money. If you actually have some experience in that, why, yes, you should. So one of the things I want to turn to my co-hosts and get some answers about is this. And Lou, I want to turn to you because you manage both projects and people. Why are skill sets around security such a problem for companies to find? And this is not new. This is not something that just suddenly erupted. This has been going on a while. Why do you think we have such a hard time developing the skill sets that companies need?
You know, the landscape's interesting because it's ever changing. I think that's the big, most difficult thing is there's different architectures out there and different infrastructures built. And the skill set for these types of things tend to be very specialized. And I think as things grow, as organizations grow, they change their landscape and they change the skills required to secure that landscape. So I definitely am seeing a lot of organizations, you know, small and large, cloud service or not, struggling to keep up with the speed of change and the speed of upgrade and the speed of these kind of growth and scale outs. And so I think that that's one of the biggest reasons is like, we're, you know, most of these organizations are looking for a particular skill set. You know, think of it like this. I think, you know, there are organizations thinking about privacy, not only just securing devices and other things. They're thinking about privacy. They're thinking about, you know, attacks and how they can get, how the malicious actors can kind of get into the system and acquire data. So I think there's a lot of different facets to think about. And again, there are a lot of specialty areas and these things just become overly complex and they're ever changing. So it's the IT individual needs to keep up, needs to continually learn over and over again, and they need to kind of stay up, so, which is why they're starting to pay the big bucks for a lot of these individuals to kind of come into organizations, especially like large organizations. So I would think that, you know, the services out there that supply information, keep people up to date, and also keep people up to date on the latest trends is also very useful for people in this industry for sure.
Well, you bring up some really interesting points about trying to keep up. And Mo, I want to turn to you with my next question. When it comes to keeping up, it seems like companies have a couple of options. They can either grow the talent among their own staff or jettison staff that hasn't learned the new technology and hire new staff. You get out there and talk to a lot of different customer organizations. From your perspective, which way do you think companies should be going? Should more companies be investing in their training for security positions, or does it make more financial sense and more operational sense for them to just hire the talent that they need, assuming they can find it?
Well, I'm going to give you the classic Wi-Fi engineer answer. The answer is always it depends. It depends on the individual, whether they're worth investing in. But there's the old joke about what if I invest in my employee and to train him and then he leaves? And the response is, well, what if you don't and he doesn't and you're stuck with someone? I think there's a lot of analogies. First of all, anyone in IT has bought themselves a lifetime of ongoing learning. There is no, I learned that and I'm done. I went to school and now I don't need to keep up with anything. IT in particular, I think, lends itself to a lifelong learner sort of person. But I think there's a good analogy between InfoSec and the Wi-Fi side. It's an add-on. You have to know something first, and then it's the specialty. There is no Wi-Fi engineer that didn't start off as a wired network engineer, and Wi-Fi is the graduate certificate, if you will. On top of that, in InfoSec, it's a great opportunity for both newbies, and there isn't anyone who knows everything about in the InfoSec side. And it's also a great place for people who've been in the game since they were 12 and have continued to learn. So I think that there's a big push to train, to keep, do the ongoing training. I think that unfortunately, especially in the U.S. and in Europe, what I see is the expectation is that the onus is on the employee, that they need to keep up with their own skill set. And that seems to have been, that just seems to be the way the IT industry in general has developed.
You're talking about developing those skills. Lou, one of the things I keep hearing companies talk about is the fact that artificial intelligence, machine learning, and automation can do the skills acquisition for us. And basically that the big computer systems will save us from this lack of human knowledge and human skill. How realistic do you think that is? Are we going to just let cloud services protect us all? Or do you think that at some point we've got to bite the bullet and grow some more security experts?
I think it's a little bit of both. I definitely think that a lot of these, we're seeing a lot of these startups and these organizations coming up with these new systems and going to go through and start detecting incoming traffic and categorizing it and training it. And so we're going to see a lot more of that for sure. I think that will definitely assist in the kind of journey along securing systems. But in the same sense, there's always going to be those attackers that will continue to grow their skills and alter their mechanisms of an attack that will simply get around these systems, because you'll have security experts around the world, you know, that are not always good actors. They could be bad actors. They know about these countermeasures and they will work around them. So I definitely think that they're, you know, moving towards more of using the data that we have already and using artificial intelligence to move into that space and to assist in that will definitely benefit the industry. But I definitely think that that's not going to be the only thing we require. So I think for sure we'll see that kind of altering and getting closer to more human involvement in the near future, for sure. Well, folks, That does it for the Bites. Next up, we have a really great guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's Sophos Cybersecurity. Now, you and I know that organizations worldwide are worried about cyber threats. We've talked about a bunch today, even. Breaches, data leaks, privacy, and more. It's a global concern. We've heard about the increased number of breaches over the last year. Well, Sophos Cybersecurity has evolved the approach to cybersecurity by using an advanced artificial intelligence to detect threats before you strike. I think Kurt heard that ringing in his ears there. Now, imagine killing ransomware viruses and cyber threats dead in their tracks. Sophos uses deep learning to interpret data and respond to threats with very little latency. There are a ton of vectors of attacks out there today, and they're increasing in sophistication. Well, this is where Sophos gets to work and make sure you are covered. Now, if you have any doubt, there was a recent independent security test done by SE Labs, and they ranked Sophos number one with the best protection ranks across the board for large enterprises and small businesses. Now, Sophos has provided advanced technology for millions of businesses worldwide with their premium capabilities brought to both on Mac and PCs alike. And there's also Sophos Home as well. And this brings real-time protection from the ransomware attacks, malicious software, and hacking attempts around the world and more. Now, you may think, well, if it does those things, it might just be tough to get installed and deployed. Well, that's where Sophos prevails. The interface is super simple. It's basically manage things online and allows you to secure your own laptop or manage the security of multiple devices on your home or around the world. Now, you can sign up for a single account and protect all the Macs and PCs in your home for a single console. And because it's cloud-based, you can even use it to keep your relatives secure, even if they are thousands of miles away. Now, you can remotely manage their security and clean up threats and keep their system safe. You can become a hero with your relatives if you're not already. Now, as you may know, Sophos' tagline is security made simple. So the whole thing is incredibly easy to use. Just log in from your browser and start securing your systems today. Now, whether you're at home or on a large organization or enterprise, Sophos has you covered. In fact, some of the largest businesses in the world use Sophos to stay protected from ransomware attacks and devastating businesses issues from last year. Now, third-party reviewers constantly rank Sophos among the best cybersecurity providers. With synchronized security, you can manage all of your Sophos products from a single cloud-based console. Get a free trial today and or a free security scan at Sophos.com. That is Sophos.com. And we thank Sophos for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it brings us to my favorite part of the show. That's to bring a guest in and drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today is no exception. We have a great guest, Kevin Anderson, co-founder and chief strategy officer of Appetize. Welcome, Kevin.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Now, our audience loves to hear about origin stories, and I really like the Appetize one as well as, you know, where you've come from. So why don't you take us through the journey of you and how you kind of got through tech and how you ended up at Appetize?
Yeah, that's great. So started Appetize about 7 years ago. And before that, my two co-founders and I, Max and Jason, were fairly early on in our careers. Max in software and in technology here in Los Angeles and Jason in operations. My background's actually in beverage distribution. So I was working in my family's beverage distribution company before Appetize, where I got to see some of the way that beverages and products were sold into large-scale enterprises like Staples Center and Dodger Stadium here in Los Angeles. And so with that background, I actually reconnected with Jason and Max. We went to junior high together, if you can believe it. We reconnected as three 23-year-olds, and we went to a Laker game and saw an incredibly broken, inefficient, expensive way of getting product in our seats. And the original idea was born in the seats at Staples Center. And we just thought that there would be a better way of ordering product. So our first product we launched back in 2012 was a mobile ordering app for consumers at concerts. And then the platform morphed tremendously over the next 4 or 5 years into something much greater than that. But, you know, sort of a fun story. It was, you know, three junior high friends reconnecting at a Laker game. And we were sick of waiting in long lines for $15 hot dogs and beers. And again, we just thought there was a better way of getting that product to us. So that was what's now a long 7 years ago.
Wow. Now, you've kind of alluded to this a little bit. Is POS systems can almost make or break an organization. In fact, they're actually responsible for all the cash and credit transactions, both from the front end and the back end, creating reports for businesses along the front. Now, I used to work on Microsoft RMS back in the day, which included POS. So I know how broad and complex the space is. Can you maybe take us through the lay of the land now? Like what are people using in the industry and how is Appetize helping?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting time in point of sale right now. It's a very divided time in point of sale. So you have the well-known sign up and go startups and now growth companies like Square and ShopKeep and Revel, who have predominantly focused on the SMB type of clients, the true sign up and go, typically stores or chains of less than, say, 15 or 20 locations. They've innovated in that they've been, you know, delivering tablet technology, but they have not moved upstream into what we would determine to be enterprise. On the other side of the industry, you have the Oracle Micros, the NCR solutions, the Agilisys solutions of the world that are still predominantly on-premise, they're Windows-based, and they're hardware-first providers. But they've been around for a long time. And so they've built out the enterprise features and functionalities that large scale properties like we work with today have. And so it's a very divided time in point of sale right now. The folks that we predominantly compete against are Micros and NCR, as they've typically just dominated the industries that we're in. We operate in sports and entertainment, in education, business dining, convention centers, theme parks, and large-scale chain restaurants and retail outlets. And in those types of environments, for the most part, Square and Revel and ShopKeep and others and Toast haven't quite broken into that part of the industry. So it's a very divided time in point of sale right now. And for the most part, we're competing against the kind of big dogs or the 800-pound gorilla in the industry, which is still Oracle Micros and NCR, obviously both publicly traded large-scale competitors.
Now, you kind of said this a little bit. Now, you've been around quite a while, and it's been – have you guys always offered like that integrated solution between hardware and software? And does that kind of help with adopting and getting organizations to move off their legacy components?
Yeah, so very much so. So we're on non-proprietary hardware that typically costs about 50% of the price of an Oracle Micros or an NCR solution. It's non-proprietary, so we're not a hardware company. We're very much software first. But we've partnered with world-class hardware partners like Elo and Apple to provide awesome hardware solutions with oftentimes much better components than any one of our competitors can offer. So it's really been a best of both worlds where we can partner with best of breed hardware partners, stay strictly focused on software. And then even on the payment terminal side of things, we've partnered with one of the most secure payment gateways out there in FreedomPay and with Ingenico and a couple of other hardware providers that have even taken some of the payment and security risk out of scope for Appetize.
Makes sense. Now, you kind of talked a little bit about some of the other competitors in the space. I think you're saying that Square is more of a mobile space and they're targeting. Now, are they targeting a different part of the market as well? Are they targeting more small business versus enterprise? Because you tend to see a lot of small businesses and startups to say they have these devices, restaurants, and so on. And so when do they know, hey, I need to kind of grow up beyond that?
No doubt, and a great question. And we've all been to that, you know, that coffee shop or restaurant where they're asking you to sign your signature on the screen on a Square device or a similar device. Today, Square is predominantly very much downstream, very much for the sign up and go, the small business. The complexity that our customers demand, and by the way, almost every week we refer business into Square and tell potential customers that they won't you know, take advantage of the horsepower we have, and that they very much might as well go with you know, a very inexpensive square solution. The horsepower that I'm talking about comes at the enterprise and the corporate level, as well as in the operational management layer of these enterprise businesses. So what Square has done really well is make an intuitive sign up and go POS on the front end, where you can take transactions and cashiers can learn the system really quickly, and you can take credit cards, you know, within a day. They've done that incredibly well. They also have very simple reporting on the back end for managers to be able to run their business. So you sell a cheeseburger and the reporting says one cheeseburger and here's the price. The complexity is, again, in the operational management layer and the enterprise management layer upstream of that. And so the complexities when you're managing Yankee Stadium, which we have 800 devices at today and transact every dollar at, the complexity for the folks managing Yankee Stadium is that they have 300 business units, again, 800 POS systems, and thousands of employees touching the system at any given time. So the reporting, the menu management, and most importantly, the inventory management layer has to be incredibly robust and incredibly strong to be able to manage each individual ingredient, so that when I sell that cheeseburger, I'm not just reporting on one cheeseburger and their price. Mm-hmm. I'm actually depleting a bun out of the 12 bun package that came on the crate a month ago and is going to decay within 45 days. So I have 15 days left to, you know, sell that particular ingredient. So that's the real complexity that we've built out on the operational management layer. And then all of that data feeds up into the corporate management layer, where somebody like a Legends Hospitality that runs Yankee Stadium, Legends is based here in Los Angeles, they can view all of our corporate dashboards and run their business from a national standpoint across venues. So that's really the complexity that we've been able to build out. And that's the complexity that a lot of our sign up and go iPad POS competitors haven't been able to build out today.
Right. Now, I've actually had the pleasure of working with Walmart in the past, and they have a fairly complex system as well. In fact, that they use a system where they're not only their POS systems are kind of hooked up directly to inventory. They know when things get low. They know when they need to go back and restock and do very sophisticated things. Is this something that Appetize also offers, or is there more complexity behind that system as well?
Yeah, so really good question. So, you know, today Appetize is really strong in food service and in retail. When it comes to specialty like grocery store or C-store or any kind of more niche industries like that, we may not be quite as good of a solution for that type of an industry. We have spent a lot of time over the last 2 years building out our retail and our fine dining software to bring alongside those solutions with our quick serve software, which we've historically been really strong in. So those are our kind of three modes that we offer to any customers: retail, fine dining, and quick serve. So when it comes to something more like a grocery store or a large box retailer like a Walmart, today Appetize wouldn't be a great fit for that, but I would expect at some point in the next year or two, with more of the integrations into the backend ERPs that we're completing, and a lot more of our inventory management as it relates to retail items and merchandise items, I'd expect it would be a great solution for something like that. There's obviously a big difference in depleting inventory as it relates to ingredients related to food as compared to something like retail and merchandise, t-shirts, that sort of thing.
Fantastic. Well, when we come back, I want to bring my co-host back in because they're chomping at the bit here in the chat and they have some questions for you. But before we do, we want to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Atlassian. Now, whether you are an engineering team that develops software or other products, you probably have used an Atlassian product or two. Now, I remember back in 2002 when Atlassian actually launched a product, it was really perfect and it was very well timed for that merging generation, which developers are committing to more agile principles. Now, originally it was conceived as a bug tracking tool, but the Jira ticket quickly became the digital record of choice for tracking units of work in highly collaborative environments. Now, for fast forward 16 years, DevOps is everyone's docket, and Atlassian is still leading the pack in areas that helps teams rise to the occasion. Atlassian really is a collaboration software company that empowers teams around the world. Like all organizations, you want to ship products faster, more efficiently, and with high quality, and ensure your customers' feedback loops adds to the business value. Now, sometimes businesses fall short with that, with the different workflows that they've implemented. Well, that's just where I've actually been doing this for a long time, and that's where Atlassian kind of jumps in and really helps. They give you and your organization the power to manage complex collaborations. Plus, their tools and services are not just for developers. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all sizes, for DevOps to Agile, IT apps to Ops to ITSM and whatever's next. Atlassian provides the technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support the kind of change that propels the business. Now, with Jira Software, Confluence, and Bitbucket, Atlassian forms the backbone of effective cross-team project planning, organization, and communication. With Jira Ops, Ops Genie, and Status Page, they help teams better detect incidents, alert response teams, coordinate response efforts to resolve issues faster, and they keep the customers or stakeholders updated. Now, your teams can choose the tools that are right for your current framework while trusting as you grow, they grow with you. Now, if it all you want to do is integrate seamlessly, well, Jira and Confluence do that, and it keeps your team from bouncing around from platform to platform. Now, I actually use Bitbucket for a lot of my repository needs and projects, and they even have features that others don't. Now, if you haven't already, go out and check them out right now. Like all Atlassian products, the tools for your IT team are easy and free to try. Just head to Atlassian.com to find out which Atlassian offering is right for your team. Try Atlassian today and unleash your IT team's potential. That's Atlassian.com. And we thank Atlassian for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Kevin Anderson, co-founder and chief strategy officer of Appetize, about POS systems. I want to actually bring my co-host back in because they've been chomping at the bit here. They have some great questions. First, I want to bring Kurt back in. You have some questions about integration and some other merchant integrations as well.
Sure. Kevin, you mentioned that you're in the process of building out integrations with some of the big ERP systems. And one of my questions was going to be, are you going to be providing direct APIs? Are you hooking into the APIs for systems like SAP and Oracle and some of the other big ERP frameworks? How is that working, and where are you? Is that something that we should see in 2019?
Yeah, absolutely. So we offer a whole reporting suite and API suite layer within Appetize Connect, which is our backend and where everything is hosted. And so, very much so. Every part of our system is able to be extracted in API format. And so some of the large, SAP, Oracle type of solutions that our customers have selected for ERP, typically at the, kind of corporate level, our APIs can feed back into those ERP solutions. So yeah, we're integrated currently to three different solutions, and I think you'll see that grow to probably five or six by the end of the year.
Well, also you were talking about your use in things like fine dining, and I'm going to assume things like fast casual and the other dining segments. Now with your product, are you also providing things like the table side handheld terminals, like, a company like Squirrel does software for that? Is that part of what you're doing, or is your simply at the cash out part of the transaction?
No. So omnichannel is a big part of, what point of sale and what our industry is talking about today. So we're not just a fixed terminal, although we can make the cashier faster and make an interface that's much easier for them to use. But we also have self-serve kiosks, as you're seeing on the screen there. And that's a huge trend in point of sale today. We're replacing a lot of stands and restaurants that used to be line-based and cashier-based with self-serve kiosks. And so not only POS, but self-serve kiosks, and then the table-side ordering handheld devices that you're talking about, which you can see there, where cashiers and wait staff can very easily choose their menu items and check out right there, swipe. And so there's no lost time where the waiter is taking your order on a piece of paper and then running back to the kitchen to then type it in back there. So it's making a lot of our customers much more efficient in their service. And that's what our products are all about, is efficiency and making the guest experience better.
Fantastic.
Well, I want to go ahead, Kurt. Go ahead, Lou.
Now, I want to give a chance. Mo had a quick question, and then we'll come back to you. I think she was going to want to talk a little bit about verticals in the space.
Great.
Right. You said that you are branching off into some new areas, and your comment about or you mentioned fine dining, and that got me interested because I was reading some of the white papers that you guys have on your website. I'm particularly interested in the kitchen display system that you have, because I have to imagine running a high-end four-star kitchen is the job of a four-star general in terms of logistics. So is there something in that kitchen display system that you have marketed, that you've developed specifically for a particular vertical, or is there anything else that you've introduced to grow into different markets?
Yeah, so the kitchen display system is very much meant for high volume scenarios. You asked about verticals. We started 7 years ago actually in sports and entertainment. So our very first customer was an arena down in San Diego. And we quickly grew penetration in sports and entertainment. We currently have a footprint in 55% of major league stadiums. We're now in about two dozen education campuses. We have several large chain restaurants on our platform. And so the kitchen display system, you know, that's a good example of a product that we had to build out over time that has a complexity of its own, and has complexity that, you know, again, Square and our other kind of sign up and go friends really haven't built out. And so this system is the system that the expo or the cook back in the kitchen is able to see all orders at any given time. There's different color codes to show them which tickets need to get out faster than the others. And the order status of each individual order is actually tied to the guest's phone number. So you can understand and know right away, hey, your order is being worked on, or your order is complete, and then finally your order is ready for pickup. So we use a lot of modern cloud technology today to sort of eliminate the pager system, to eliminate those systems where you're putting up a number on a screen or calling a name out. We reach right into the guest's pocket and give them the updates right from this kitchen display system. So it's not only functional from a back of house complexity standpoint, but it's also reaching from a technology standpoint into guests' pockets and giving them updates without you having to do anything extra.
Okay, so you're gathering the guest phone number. So what was your opinion on our GDPR conversation earlier?
Well, I think it's something that we've had to do a lot of thinking about. We collect a whole lot of data, as you can imagine, from credit card information to last name, to what type of credit card you're using. We also capture phone numbers, email addresses, digital signatures. And so we've had to go through a whole lot of compliance and security checks, PCI compliance. We're up to date very much so on. From a payment perspective, again, we use Freedom Pay, so that's a PCI validated solution. So we actually don't receive any of that encrypted information ourselves. But overall, I mean, I think it's something that businesses have to be very careful about, and software companies can't just collect that data and do whatever they want with it. We've had to be very careful when our customers, like a Yankee Stadium or like a Tropical Smoothie Cafe, some of these big, large brand names that are large customers of Appetize, when they ask for some of that information and we actually haven't asked the guest for the ability to have that business use it, we have to be very careful about what we allow those customers or those businesses to use. So I thought it was very apropos in some ways that I was coming on, you know, right after that, because security is one of the kind of three or four biggest things that we talk about as a company.
Fantastic. Kurt, I'm going to throw it back to you.
All right. Well, you know, I want to get into this question about the data that you're gathering, because I can understand from a PCI compliant standpoint why you would want to be very careful about what you actually touch in terms of data. I also know that with a lot of these customers, they have things like loyalty programs. How complex is it when you have to factor in things like the data for loyalty programs with the data required just for the financial transactions.
Yeah. So, you know, the fantastic thing when we have, I like to call it a trigger on the front end, right? When we have some sort of trigger from loyalty to a wristband to a gift card, some way of knowing who that guest is, that allows us to pull that information, save that information, and make sense of who that customer is on an ongoing basis. So we can serve up things like your favorite order for speed of transactions. Or we can even offer, if you swipe your card at one of our kiosks, we can give you an offer that is relevant to you. So we know if you've purchased Coors Light in the past, well, maybe we'll give you a discount on that, or maybe we'll give you a discount on trying a different product. So loyalty is something that we very much push. We have our own loyalty solution, and then we have a group of loyalty partners that we integrate out to. So all of that data we collect in Appetize Connect, kind of the brains behind all of the products you see on the front end, we collect all of that data, and then we can display that in a secure way back to our customers, and also display in our point of sale products and in our kiosk products ways to be able to encourage faster checkout and checkout that actually is contextual for who you are in front of that kiosk or in front of that point of sale. More and more, and you know, more and more of where we're going in 2019 and 20 is understanding who that guest is, and including things like upsells and really understanding who's in front of our devices.
Well, I can certainly understand that. My last question regards the payment type. You know, a lot more consumers are moving to some sort of mobile payment sort tied typically to their smartphone. And I've talked to people in the payment card industry who are beginning to plan for what they see as a day when the standard credit card goes the way of cash in a lot of things, where it just disappears and pretty much everyone is paying through some sort of mobile tokenized payment system. What's your take on that? Do you find from your end that using the mobile payment makes the security a little bit easier, or is it all kind of the same from your perspective?
Well, mobile payment, it's factual that it is safer and more secure than your credit card. So very much we encourage that type of use. It's interesting, in our industries, Apple Pay still only accounts for 3-5% of all transactions, cash being about 40%, credit being about 55-60%. And so you're still seeing people use a heck of a lot of cash and a heck of a lot of credit cards in environments where you'd think they would be more innovative, like entertainment arenas and stadiums. So I think it's going to be really interesting to follow what happens over the next few years. You would have guessed that Apple Pay adoption would have increased by now. I do think that we're going to start to see things like biometrics, which we're integrating into a couple of different providers as we speak, to allow folks in stadiums that are already using biometric to get into the stadium from an access standpoint and a ticketing standpoint. We'll allow that those folks to take it a step further and pay with their thumbprint or their iris at the point of sale system with the account that they've already created. And so I think that I hope that Apple Pay and that NFC payment continues to tick up, hopefully at a faster pace than it is today. But I do think you're going to start to see some pretty interesting payment types over the next few years. And I wouldn't be surprised if biometric does leap or lap credit card payment here in the next few years.
Now, that kind of leads me into my next question here. I think, you know, you talked a little bit about some of the pretty unique up and coming features. Now, if we go a little bit more higher level here, when an organization is kind of looking for a POS system, you know, what variables and features do they need to look for or consider when it comes to that?
Well, I think number one is cloud, right? I know that's probably shocking to hear me say, but enterprise businesses haven't moved to the cloud by and large when it comes to point of sale. A lot of our customers were very scared about moving off premise and into the cloud. A lot of folks, a lot of CIOs and CTOs 3 or 4 years ago thought they'd lose their job for choosing Appetize versus a Micros or an NCR solution. So number one, I would say, is a truly fully cloud fully mobile solution that can be flexible with today's software and today's environment. The second thing I would say is take a look deep under the hood, look at the inventory management tools, look and see if that platform has heat maps where you can run your business from a live view standpoint. So many of our customers are used to going to some server room to download an Excel spreadsheet at 3 a.m. after the event or after they've already closed their doors, only to see that a cashier was stealing from them the whole time, or only to see that they should have had inventory in a certain stock in a certain location. And if they had, they would have saved costs and increased revenues. And so I'd say take a deep look under the hood and see if that provider has a live inventory solution and live reporting in heat map format so that you can see all 100, all 1,000 of your devices laid out across your property, and so that you can see sales, inventory management, loss prevention, and even network diagnostics across those devices, all in a visual format so that you can make decisions live, and so that you're not caught with your tail between your legs at 3 a.m. going, shoot, I would have made these 20 decisions if I had live alerts, if I had heat maps, if I had an inventory management solution. And so those would be kind of the two things that I would look for is on the front end, are we in the cloud? Are we using an omni-channel approach? Don't just go for the system that has a sleek point of sale. Look for something that also allows you to future-proof. A lot of our customers are moving slowly away from the point of sale and going more into self-service, into kiosk, into some of the table-side ordering and line busting that we've already talked about. And so I'd look on the front end and see that omni-channel cloud-based solution. And then on the back end, I'd be looking for that inventory management, that heat mapping, the live analytics on the back end to truly run your business so that you're not caught, again, after closing your doors, wishing you had made decisions differently.
Fantastic. Well, unfortunately, we're running a little low on time, but I did want to ask you one other question that kind of leads into this question around, like, I'm an organization. I have a, you know, a kind of an old school POS system. It's kind of an on-premise system. It's not connected. Where do I go? How do I get started? How do I determine what do I need to do to get on to Appetize and move forward? And how do I do that?
So very simply, go to getappetize.com, fill out a small form that'll go right to our sales team and we'll be in touch. Really easy process. It's not quite the sign up and go Square process, as like I mentioned, a lot more horsepower than a Square and not meant to be sign up and go. But in just a couple of weeks time, you can be up and running with up to 100, even up to 500, 1,000 devices. Really easy to get on board. We train oftentimes mostly remotely, and then we have a team that's on site that'll do the install and the training in person. A lot of our biggest deployments, like with Live Nation, we deployed 4,000 POS units in just 30 days time. We retrained 5,500 employees on the system. So the system's really easy to use on the front end for cashiers. It'll be a little bit of a life-changing experience for those general managers on the back end.
Fantastic. Kevin Anderson, co-founder and chief strategy officer of Appetize. Kevin, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate you being on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, Lou.
Take care. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 POS transactions. But I want to thank those folks who make this show possible, especially my co-hosts in crime, the brains of the outfit here, starting with Heather Williams. Thanks again for being on the show. Heather, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, I actually, you're not going to be able to find me very easily for the next couple of months because the gods, all of them, the old, the new, the drowned, the many-faced, all hate me. I will be back in Vegas next week, but you can always check me out at Twitter at MoBetterWiFi, where I'm usually just lurking, but sometimes have something snarky to say to someone.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Mo. Of course, we have to thank our favorite journalist, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, I'm not as lucky as Heather. I don't get to head to Las Vegas until early May, but next month I will be heading over to San Francisco. In the meantime, you can always find what I'm writing about at darkreading.com. This coming week, I've got a piece coming up on things you should know if you're setting up an access control list. So we go from the news to the practical and back again. And I will always point to what I'm writing at my Twitter account. That's at KG4GWA.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we also have to thank you. You are the person that drops in each and every week to listen and learn about enterprise tech news of the week. And we want to make it easy for you to get your enterprise goodness. Go out right now to twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, the show notes, information about our guests, our co-hosts, and of course, links to the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to all that stuff, next to the videos there, you actually see those helpful subscribe and download links to help and support the show by downloading your audio version or video version or HD video version of your choice to listen on the device of your choice. It's the best way to get your enterprise tech news. So go ahead and subscribe right now. Now, after you've subscribed, go ahead and share it with your friends and family, your coworkers is definitely the best way to get your enterprise goodness for the week. And we love doing this show. Now, after you subscribe, also remember we do this show each and every week live at Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time at live.twit.tv. And of course, if you're going to go jump in, actually listen to the show or watch the show live, we might as well jump into the chat room live as well as irc.twit.tv. We get some really great discussions and some questions from the chat room each and every week. So we love working with the chat room. So go ahead and jump in there as well. Also, don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. Of course, you can always see all the work that I'm doing there, as well as if you go to dev.office.com, you can check out all the greatest things that I actually work on a daily basis about how to make Office more productive for you by customizing it and extending it. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week. We also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially the engineers at Twit, and of course our loyal producer, Mr. Brian Chee. He's lurking in the chat rooms here today. We thank you for his support. He gets the guests. He sets everything up. We thank you for all of his work he does for the show. Of course, we want to thank our TD for today, Victor. Thank you so much for being here, sir. Again, tradition. We have to continue this tradition. I know we all love it. We want to continue it. What was the major topic of today's show?
Well, just like last time, it's almost lunchtime, so I think it has something to do with how you're going to buy me lunch today.
Fantastic. I just might have to do that next time in there. Fantastic. Thanks, Victor. No problem. Well, maybe next time. Until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying and just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.